Blog Talk Radio.
Peter Paul Brazola. It was a little too loud. We're trying a new theme. This is My Country. It's a song written in 1940, just before the United States entered the war. I think it's very appropriate for what's going on in this country today, where Americans who are native-born are being disenfranchised by these illegal aliens, these people who have betrayed their own citizenship, their own Native American origins and our ideals and our values for this, what you can call one worldism or whatever. But I think it's time, and there are a growing number of us who think it's time that we get back to our values, and some of it will be helpful with music, like the Stars and Stripes Forever, which is the national march, and of course, God Bless America. Music like that. Sorry about that. Well, we'll get that moderated down. It was taken from an interview I did with the Clydesdale Horses, which you've seen them with Budweiser, and it's one of the fun interviews, along with the dogs that accompanied the wagons with the Clydesdale Horses. And of course, we have today some wag decided that this piece of music is appropriate for what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. And see what you think of this.
Might be offered the following advice.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibut and the sturgeon, the being wiped out by detergent. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly. But they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill if the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose.
Well, a little humor there with all of this seriousness that's going on today. Especially in New York, what's got people very upset, of course, is under the guise of freedom of religion and First Amendment rights, they're sticking it in our eye, these politicized imams. Of course, Islam is very political and always has been. It's a religion that believes its manifest destiny is to, the extremists in it anyway, to conquer Christianity, convert them. And one of the things they never talk about was one of the horrible things that they did when they would abduct young Christian boys. The Islam ships, primarily the Turks, when it sailed as far north as what is today Lithuania, Latvia, those countries. And maybe we see some of the, you see some of these blonde, blue-eyed Arabs, they're probably the descendants of these kids who were abducted. And what happened, whenever the Muslim armies would capture a Christian, they would do a half-circumcision. That's where the term Christian dog comes from. And it's very brutal, and Sir Richard Burton wrote about some of this when he was the great, not Richard Burton, the actor, but Richard Burton, the 19th century explorer in Africa and Saudi Arabia. And unfortunately, he wrote a lot of detailed stuff in his explorations, but unfortunately, his wife survived him, and she burned a lot of his manuscripts and the work that he had done and documented. But we got a pretty good idea of the French Foreign Legion, the things that happened to them in North Africa, which brings us to the proposed 9/11 mosque. You know, it's interesting that whether you build a church or you build a school or a grocery store or a Walmart, every municipality has in its jurisdiction the right to zone. And I think, and a lot of other people think, that this is a zoning issue. As a matter of fact, I don't know if the guy's gay or not, but we are hearing that a New Yorker has applied to set up a permit to construct or to install a gay bar if that mosque is given the permit to build where they want to build. So that's going to be real interesting. We'll see about how tolerant, if that mosque is built, how tolerant these Islamic Muslims are. Now, the other thing is people don't know or haven't studied, and our media hasn't informed people about the term Cordoba. We're not talking about the Chrysler car. Cordoba is a famous city in Spain. It has a lot of rich history. And it was the area of Spain where, and those of you who've seen the movie El Cid with Charlton Heston and Sophia Loren and Herbert Lom, great film. It gets into some of the history of Islam and their military forays and adventures, conquests in Spain. And for 300 years, the Moors and the Arabs had come up from North Africa, and they went as far. They tried to go into France. I think Charles Martin, not the founder of the cognac, but they were. I believe they were stopped at Tours. And the interesting thing about those of you who are into horses, interesting thing about the Islams, were the famous Arabian steeds, very fast, but they're light. And the Franks, as they were called at the time, when the Muslims tried to go into France and extend their conquest, the French had the heavier horses. And that's one of the things their cavalry could withstand the attacks by the Islamists with their lighter steeds. But you know, we got to give credit to their veterinary and their animal husbandry knowledge. And the Moors had been in Spain for parts of Spain for 300 years. They were great with astronomy. They did some things in the science. However, they did enslave Spanish natives and sell them into slavery. And even today, we have Arabs who are involved in slavery in parts of Africa. It's diminished quite a bit, but it was the Arabs who were selling, were the slave dealers, who were selling the blacks to the Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, and the Americans. And it was the Portuguese was the last people to stop dealing in slaves. But the Arabs were very big in it. They talk about how they have humanity for their fellow man, but their fellow human being. But they were in the slave trade, and they did horrible things to the Africans. But as soon as I heard the term Cordoba, I knew they weren't talking about a Chrysler car, even though we have the Chrysler building in New York City. I don't know if it's still called Chrysler, but Cordoba, in the extreme Muslim mentality and their idea of history and manifest destiny, and yes, they believe in that too, the extremists. Cordoba represented the height of the Muslim influence and after their conquest of parts of Spain. And it was Ferdinand and Isabella, those of you who are familiar or who have familiarized yourself with Christopher Columbus, before he could get the support of Isabella and Ferdinand, when the Spanish, Spain was divided into areas. Isabella and Ferdinand, Castile, and I forget the other name on me, part Spanish, not Aragon, but through marriage, they merged their parts of Spain, and then their first idea was to drive out the Muslims and install Christianity or Catholicism as the dominant religion. There were Jews there too. And after they did that, Columbus had to wait around to get. He finally commits Isabella to back the financing of his three ships to find a route to the east. They end up in the so-called. There's dispute about this here in the Western Hemisphere in Santo Domingo. But this is all part of the history of that. And what they did, what the Muslims did when they conquered that part of Spain, Cordoba. And there was a Catholic cathedral there. And what they did was they desecrated the cathedral and made it into one of the biggest mosques, third biggest mosque in the world at the time. Now, to give you an idea of a similar situation, those of you who are familiar with the Byzantine Empire, that was the part of when Rome and the two emperors, there was the Emperor of the East and the Emperor of Rome, and they had that, when Rome declined, they had the split. And the barbarians took over. They were fighting the barbarians in the east, which would be Byzantium. But they were Catholic. They were Christian. They were Catholics. And what happened when the Islamists or the Muslims finally conquered what is now Turkey? That cathedral was called Saint Sophia. They turned it into one of the biggest mosques, and it was in the news when Pope Benedict. It's kind of funny. Since it was a Catholic church at one time, when he visited Turkey, that he went into what was formerly Saint Sophia and is now a mosque. But this is part of their history, and we've got to learn these things. And as soon as I heard the term Cordoba, I said they weren't talking about cars. So hopefully the New Yorkers will say, hey, this shouldn't be zoned here. You wouldn't put. To draw you an analogy, you wouldn't allow a homosexual bathhouse to be constructed or set up near a grammar school or a kindergarten. You wouldn't allow a pot dispensary to be set up next to unless you're in San Francisco, next to a grammar school. So it's a matter of zoning, we think, and that's the way to deal with it. And it's a legitimate a way to stop this. Construction of this proposed 9/11 Cordoba mosque. So we need to, all of us need to refresh ourselves in history. Even me, I forgot about I think it was Isabella of Aragon and Ferdinand of Castile, but I've got to refresh that myself. Now, since we're talking about horses, this is one of my favorite interviews, and here goes. An interview I did with the Clydesdale horses. I also did one with the Lipizzaner, the people at the Vienna Riding Academy, the Spanish Riding School. And we'll do that interview later. But here goes the Clydesdale horses.
Hi friends, this is Peter Paul, and on this Sunday morning I've got a surprise treat for you. I'm talking to Lloyd Ferguson of the Budweiser Clydesdale horses. Welcome to the program. Hi Lloyd.
How do you do this morning?
Lloyd, why did Budweiser choose these particular horses?
Well, I would have to say because they consider these Clydesdales pretty much the Rolls Royce of the draft horse breed. They have a natural high-stepping action. They got the four white feathered legs, white faces, deep bay color. They range in height from 17 up to 19 hands tall and average around a ton in weight.
What's a draft horse?
A draft horse is a large type of horse, generally 800 up to 1,000 pounds heavier than a light horse, and originally their main purpose was for pulling heavy loads and working in our fields. They were replaced by our trucks and tractors of today.
So when Budweiser originally started as a brewery, these horses were used?
Yes, they at one time did deliver Budweiser with the horses, and then later on become a advertising vehicle in 1933, and this year is our 50th anniversary for having the Clydesdale travel.
Of course, the horses aren't that old. What is that longevity?
They can live up to 20 years.
20 years?
What's the average age of the horses that you use?
Right now, the average of this team that we have with us is, I guess, around 7 years old.
How many horses do you have totally?
We have 10 with us here right now. There are three teams in the nation, and they're
constantly on tour?
Yeah, they travel all the time. Our home base is in Southern California, south of Riverside, a place called Romoland, California. They have a team based in St. Louis, Missouri, and one in Merrimack, New Hampshire.
What do these horses eat? Do they get anything special?
They eat around 50 pounds of feed a day. They get a mixture of crimped oats, bran, and beet pulp twice a day, and that is around 25 to 30 quarts, and then they get free choice of alfalfa or Timothy hay.
I heard that some pet food companies use yeast from the process of beer. Is any leftover products from beer brewing used for feeding horses?
We don't feed any, but I've heard of people doing it. A lot of it's sent to dairies and feedlots, things of that nature.
What are the sexes of these horses?
These are all geldings. We don't carry any of the mares on our teams. It'd be awful hard on them, the amount that we travel on the road, to be in foal and be carrying a colt. So, for that reason, we just take the geldings.
These horses travel in splendor. They're the Rolls Royces of the horse.
Yes, we have three custom-built tractor trailers. Two of them carry the horses and the portable stalls, and one carries the wagon and the harness.
Now, what's their temperament like?
They are a very good-natured horse, and these ones here are particularly good-natured, I believe, partially due to the fact that our handlers are working with them year-round.
Did the kids of a century ago, were these the type of horses that they rode in the fields?
These horses, it said at one time that these are the horses that the knights rode in the Crusades. And then,
no wonder they took a long time to get to Palestine.
Then later on they were crossed with the Flemish stallions in Scotland, and we got this very large, high-stepping breed.
How long have they been in the United States?
I couldn't say for sure how long this breed has been in the nation.
So if these are geldings, what do you do when you have to replace one?
Well, we have a breeding farm at Grant's Farm in St. Louis, Missouri, and it's constantly producing new stock for the team.
So you have a regular breeding farm. You have about 40, 50 horses currently?
Well, altogether the company probably owns 150 head.
So like these horses that we will see in San Francisco will only travel a West Coast circuit?
Yeah, we travel 13 western states and western Canada.
You travel in the wintertime?
Yes, we're going pretty well full-time. For this year, our total time at home will be around 77 days. So it's been a pretty full year.
So the horses are on the circuit about 300 days a year then, huh?
Yes.
Any final comments there, Lloyd?
This bud's for you, I guess.
Strohs, Coors, eat your heart out. This is Peter Paul, down here on Pier 45 with the most famous horses in the world, more famous than the Lipanonzers. This is Peter Paul with the Clydesdale Horses. Thanks for listening.
And we did a supplement with the dogs that accompany the Clydesdales on the wagon. So here goes that interview. We had to break it up.
Lloyd, you have two Dalmatians. Are these horses racing to a fire?
No, these are our coach dogs. The Dalmatian, not only used in fire departments, is a coach dog, and with us it's a tradition. They've had the dogs with the teams for 50 years now, and we just carry our two Dalmatians. They're company for us and the horses.
Were they originally used to keep people away from the cask of beer when the man was delivering them?
Well, I've heard that it goes back as far as Egypt, when the Egyptians had their horses and chariots, and the Dalmatian chased alongside the chariot and chased stray dogs away.
What are the names of these dogs?
Our male is Budweiser and our female is Miss Michelob.
You're not feeding them anything, are you?
No, they won't drink.
Do you have two types of dogs for each team? I mean, do you have two dogs on each team?
Yes. Find that it works better having two dogs. They keep each other company, and in real hot weather, they can change off, too.
So, like, there will always be one dog on the carriage?
Yeah, that's correct.
What do these dogs eat? Now, you're in St. Louis. Do you feed them Purina?
Well, you got to find that black and white dog food.
Well, that could be either. You're out here in the West Coast.
Yeah, we feed them Calcan and Purina High Protein.
Ah, well, being a working dog, they'll need the protein. Well, how old are the dogs? What are their average age?
Our male's going to be 5 in November, and our female was 4 this past May.
Do you have a breeding farm for them, or are they bred on the same farm?
Yes, they do breed some back in St. Louis.
We won't ask any more questions about what you're feeding them. Thanks, Lloyd, for being on the program.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed those interviews, and there'll be more. We did about 1,500 when I was with Western Public Radio and KLW here in San Francisco, and that interview was done in San Francisco, and we did interviews in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, back east, and here in the States. So we're going through all our archives, getting we have a lot of interesting stuff from famous lawyers like Mel Belli, personal friend. He's dead now. And then Gladys Sargent, who was married into the John Singer Sargent family. She was the animal welfare top lobbyist here in California, famous woman, and was involved with Pets and Pals, animal welfare organization that you put her money into. So we'll come back. We're going to the dogs. Incidentally, those of you who have seen, when you see, and I suggest you do see, the Wehrmacht in Russia in the wintertime, you will see these big horses that the will be pulling the German, they'll be pulling carts, they'll be pulling trucks, they'll be pulling, I haven't seen any pull tanks. But those horses were like the Clydesdales. They were pampered horses in the German breweries, and they pulled the carts that had the kegs of beer. Well, when Hitler launched his ill-fated invasion of Russia, and they got bogged down in the Russian winter, and the oil in the engines froze, it was a very bad campaign, and nobody wins in a land war in Russia, and he didn't pay attention to what Napoleon had suffered. But anyway, the horses that they were desperate, so for Hitler ordered the horses to be taken out of the brewery stables in Germany and shipped to Russia to pull the vehicles and pull the carts. And these horses were pampered, and they were not accustomed to this kind of stress, and they dropped dead of heart attack. Can you believe that? Incredible animal cruelty. And here Hitler was supposed to be an animal lover, besides being a wacko vegetarian. It's very interesting, just to digress here, Custer was known as a horse killer. He was in the cavalry in the Civil War, and Union Cavalry, and he on his military in the military campaigns that he participated in, he really put the horses to extreme paces, as it were, and Lincoln was having a hell of a time getting horses to replace all the horses that were being killed in that conflict. And this is where we get, to digress even further, we get what is known as the Quitam Law, dating back to the Lincoln administration. What was happening was because they were killing so many horses, they couldn't replace them fast enough with good quality horse flesh. And so the government was being sold defective horses, in effect. So Lincoln got angry and got this law passed called Quitam, which means that anybody who rips off the government, if a citizen finds out about it, he can, with a lawyer — it's the only case that requires a certified lawyer, and we'll get into that another time because I've had some experience on that field — can file a civil action against a person who's ripped off the federal government. There's also a state quitam, they call it false claims. And the government has an option within 30 days to take over that case, and then you get a cut of the percentage if the government wins. Otherwise, if they decline, then you have to get your own one who has passed the bar, and then you fight the case, and it's called quitam. So that was the origin of it, because the government was being sold defective horse flesh, in effect. But it's amazing what they do to these horses. And when you see these horses in these movies, you know, the old Western movies, or you see the British cavalry, the French cavalry, or even at Waterloo, they have to be very solicitous of how they stage those battles so that you don't kill the horses or injure them. But things do happen. I thought that was interesting when I saw those big draft horses pulling the carts in the winter time, the horrible Russian winter. And then we discovered, doing some research, that those horses were under such stress that they were dropping dead of a heart attack. And it's something I've never heard of before, even growing up on a farm. Now, the other thing is we're seeing in the news this incident in Atlanta, where they had huge lines, I understand, I didn't see all of them, of people trying to get Section 8, which is a house subsidy, housing subsidy from the federal government on the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it's really interesting, the scandals that went on with this. I was asked to investigate it. Here in San Francisco, which is ahead of Region 9, there was a guy at HUD, which has the regional office here in the federal building, was selling these Section 8s for $500 a Section 8, and there were people waiting in line for years. Even the corruption was so bad in this program, and there's another scandal with it involving the Steve Neri Juan Pieper case, people were waiting in line, you know, who had signed up and were waiting their turn because they were very valuable to get a Section 8. And this HUD official was selling them for $500 a crack. And when they found out about it, instead of prosecuting the clown, they shipped them to Las Vegas, where the Las Vegas Housing Authority, where it presumably did the same thing. Incidentally, go to my – I hope you don't hear cacophony outside. That's not the Budweiser Dalmatians. There's nothing I can do about this this extraneous noise. Sorry about that. But excuse me. So on my YouTube site, if you want to see the entire index, we've got close to 90 video verites, or it's a video magazine, Amicus Veritas, AMICUS. VERITAS at YouTube, and we have a HUD official, Fitzhugh, who not only had got three condos from developers who did business with HUD, real dirty guy, was the head of Indian and Public Housing for Region 9, and what was going on was there's another program called HAP, Homeless Assistance Payments, and what this became a scam at the Sweetheart Hotel here in San Francisco, which is involved in a scandal this very day. Some art forger or hustler was fencing artwork and got caught. But what was going on was these politicians set up these 501c3 affordable housing corporations, or they take over one in existence. And what had happened then, they used their influence peddling to get federal housing contracts. And they set up this hotel in San Francisco's Tenderloin, and we call it the Sweetheart Hotel. We discovered, we had an informant inside, and we got a hold of records and everything and canceled checks or backs, canceled front and back. Discovered that these homeless assistance payments were going to, in some cases, people couldn't identify that lived in the building because the person that we got the material from was the manager, or one of the managers. But the most interesting fraud in that program was a guy who was the head of HUD, the first black head of HUD in Region 9, Pitts, Robert Bedford Pitts. He died in 1982. So we got his death certificate with the Social Security number, and we matched it to the checks, which was about $27,000. That was a monthly payment for all the people on that program. And they have the Social Security numbers of the people because some of them are common names. And the name Robert Bedford Pitts popped up with the same Social Security number. The scam gets even better. And this is why there's limited housing, because of all this racketeering that's going on with these and an influence peddling. The deal was about $590 a month for a room in this homeless hotel, the Sweetheart Hotel. Then there was, if the guy vacated before the lease was up, the HUD had to pay a vacancy fee to the guy that operated the hotel, in this case Chinese Community Housing. There's another scandal with them. And then if there was any damage, that's another $400 or $500. So this guy never existed. So the operator of this hotel was getting got about $1,100 in 1 month. First of all, for the rent, for the non-existent of the dead tenant, which they disinterred like they did in voting. You heard of the dead rising to vote or being resurrected? Well, apparently they resurrected the dead to get homeless assistance payments here in San Francisco, and we don't know how extensive it was in Region 9 or in Northern California. There were other of these payments made out to this politician who ran this hotel, and this is a part of the problem why there's little or no housing funds available for the people who are truly needy and who deserve, who are entitled, truly entitled, to get this aid from the federal government. Now, the other scandal with the Section 8s involves Castro Kling. This is a guy who was an employee in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office under the corrupt administration of Terrence Hallinan, and he was involved in forging federal papers to get Steve Neri off the USS Carl Vinson. We'll get into that more specifically another day. He got exposed by us. I was asked by the U.S. Navy to investigate the case because I knew all the parties for the last 35, 40 years. Anyway, he mysteriously got $3,500 a month, Section 8, for the buildings that he was invested in. How he was entitled to get this money. Here's a corrupt local attorney, and these guys are what they call at will. They don't have civil service protection. They don't have the right to encumber the state on agreements. They're just there to prosecute a case, and half the time it's a corrupt prosecution. That's what's going on here in San Francisco, and it's costing the American taxpayer millions of dollars when it's all added up. We've already had a payout to one guy, the Tennyson case, railroaded into state prison for 14 years. The city had to pay the poor victim, Mr. Tennyson, about $5 million. And, of course, you know where that money comes from, the American taxpayer. So, and that's not the only case. There are other cases like that, and they will come to, they will see the light, and these people will be compensated, and hopefully the people that pull these stunts will themselves be behind bars in some of the worst prisons in this state. Maybe the federal prisoners ship them out to one of these foreign countries. Anyway, this is what goes on with the Section 8 program and with homeless assistance payments to dead people. So go to our YouTube site, and we'll document more of this. You know, we like to document stuff so we can't be attacked. And the newspapers, and then also in this affordable housing, we had one of the dirtiest newspaper people. We called him Dirty Dennis, Dennis Opachini. He worked for the San Francisco Examiner, then for a legal paper. Big liar, big scumbag. He got an affordable condo that was funded in part, mostly in part, by the HUD housing program. There are so many programs, it's hard to keep up with them. So, you know, and then when I exposed him, and we'll put his condo up there with the documents, he eventually sold the condo. I don't know what he's doing now, who he's doing or what he's doing to the person he's with. But these are some of the corrupt media. This is why this stuff goes on. And also the corporate and the alternative media, like the Bay Guardian, and corporate media like the Hearst Papers, the Chronicle, they know about this because some of them have also benefited. But they censor and suppress these scandals. And, of course, it's the American taxpayer that pays for this and pays for the cover-up. You know, and the only way we're going to change these things is to finally stand up and say, we've had enough. An indication may be what the public's beginning to realize about these scumbags, these what I call media morons, is they're not buying the papers that used to be by 10 o'clock in the morning. You used to see the Chronicle's boxes empty because people had paid the 50, 75 cents, whatever. That's what it costs now to buy to get the paper. Now the papers are left in the box. People aren't buying them, and they don't believe what's printed. They know that half of it's lies, and the other half is, all the omissions that they should have reported and could have reported and didn't report. So this goes on, and people are wising up to the corruption, and they've had it up to here because we've seen what's happened with this corrupt situation in Washington. Some interesting birthdays today. Truly some people have gone to the dogs. Well, the events first. Since we're very concerned about race, two events occurred about 70 years apart. First was Nat Turner's revolt. He was a black slave, self-educated, well-educated on his own. He started a slave rebellion, I think, in South Carolina in 1831. And it was very successful, but it was very brutal. And, of course, the people at the time put it down. And he eluded the capture for several months. When he was finally captured, he was convicted, and hung. But there were about 200 blacks, and several of them were innocent. The whites just went on a rampage and just decided to do a lesson like the Germans used to do. You kill one German soldier, there'll be 10 of the natives that'll be killed, 10 or 100. So this is what happened in the Nat Turner Rebellion. And then in 1906, excuse me, we had the Brownsville case, where there was a black regiment in the U.S. Army. Some of these guys had served faithfully excuse me, for about 20 years. They were ready to retire. What happened was there was a lot of racism in people who were familiar with Texas. There's a lot of racism still even down there today. Excuse me. And what had happened was there was an altercation that erupted into a fatality, and then there was a race riot, and the U.S. Army's black soldier, this black regiment, all black, was condemned, and they were, in effect, falsely accused of starting the riot and killing people and all of that. Well, what happened was the Army said, who investigated the case, the Army official said, no, you know, our people are not to blame. But anyway, what had happened was the local politicians prevailed, white racists, and Teddy Roosevelt was president at the time. Now, a lot of people don't realize, don't know Teddy Roosevelt's racism. One of the reasons he got involved in the Russo-Japanese War was that he couldn't stand to see a white nation, the Russians, being defeated by a dark race, the Japanese. And he used to refer, this is how he referred to the races, and he used to call them, the Chinese were the god and the Chinese, dirty Chinese. And we had the Chinese problems here in the country with legal and illegal immigration, especially here on the West Coast. And then he referred to the Japanese as the plucky little Japs. And, of course, he brokered the peace treaty between the Russians and the Japanese at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and he got the first Nobel Peace Award given to a U.S. president. And we'll get into it. There's a fascinating story of a connection of that Russian ship that was here in San Francisco in June, the Vareg. It has an interesting history, or it's the second ship to carry that name, and it has a connection to the U.S. Supreme Court. I will get into that in the coming shows. I'm almost finished with the research. But anyway, the whole 25th Army Regiment was because TR couldn't get these guys to confess to make a false confession that they were responsible for the riot and the killing in Brownsville, Texas. So he discharged en masse the entire regiment, dishonorably discharged these guys. And to this, you know, he refused. Booker T. Washington had dinner with him at the White House. TR refused to reconsider his executive decision, which, as commander-in-chief, he was entitled to do that. And so it's one of the blotches, big blotches, in his in the history of his life. TR was a very strange bird, but, you know, it's one of the biggest disgraces of the American presidency, what TR did to that regiment. And these guys, they could never get a government job. You know, dishonorable discharge is leprosy for life, in effect, that nobody wants to hire you. You're branded. It's like there's a famous episode in the known as the Irish who were in the U.S. Army, and they decided in the Mexican War to join the Mexicans who were fighting the U.S. Army. And the Irish Brigade, that was called, when they were captured by the U.S. Army, General Winfield Scott and Zachary Taylor, they would brand the deserters or traitors on the cheek with a hot brand. And it's a famous movie about that. But again, I don't know if there's any movie on this Brownsville, Texas situation. But that's one of the shameful episodes in Teddy Roosevelt's life. Interesting birthdays. There's not many, that seems, this summer. In 1899, Alfred Hitchcock was born today, and it's interesting. Kind of got a connection to one of his actresses, Kim Novak. We both had the same speech teacher. And then here is somebody who truly went to the dogs, Alfred Krupp. He was born in 1907, and he was the head of Germany's biggest steel factory at Essen. I've been there. It's an awful place. You know, the Krupp steel was famous for its strength, and built it was used in the Panzer tanks and German warships, submarines. And, of course, he was tried as a war criminal after the war. Unlike the Japanese, he wasn't hung. And then, of all people, and I used to think this guy was a great liberal fighting oppression in Cuba, Fidel Castro, and his last name is Ruz, R-U-Z. He only uses his first and middle name. He was born today. You know, you would think he would be dead. But he's still around and causing trouble down there. And then we had, getting back to Turkey, Kemal Mustafa became the president of Turkey and what is modern Turkey after the old caliphs or the emperors of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, was called the sick old man of Europe. And Ataturk modernized Turkey and made it a resurgent, powerful country that it is today. And, of course, I did do the interviews of the last British-American survivor of Gallipoli, Colonel Hodges. He was a British lieutenant in the Grenadier Guards at Gallipoli, and he survived Gallipoli because he got sick, and they medevaced him on the sister ship of the Titanic, the Britannic. Fascinating story. We'll run that interview again. And after the war, there was a depression in England, after World War I, so he went. He emigrated like a lot of Brits did who were in the British Army, and that came to America, and he went to work for Chrysler. And in World War II, we were about to get involved, the War Department, it was called War Department at the time, not the, what has become the U.S. Department of Defense, put out the call that there were about 10,000 British officers, former British officers living in the States, and they recruited them to train the emerging American army, because Roosevelt knew in 1940 we were going to get into the war eventually. So he became a colonel, and they gave him a WAC division out here in Northern California, and some fascinating stories about that, and that's why we call him the last British-American survivor. I was in Perth, Australia as a correspondent, and I was not told at the time, even though I was a guest of the Australian government, that the last British survivor lived there. Had I known, I could have, Perth is not that big a town, I would have interviewed him, but nobody, I didn't know at the time, and I guess, that's just how these things happen. But he died a couple years ago, so there's no more survivors. And then the last British survivor of World War One, a guy named Allenshan, I think, he died last year. So, they're all, the maggots get everybody. It's just a matter that, but I guess the taste is different, as I told somebody once. But, we have a lot of history that we'd like to bring up because things really, what's the phrase? Everything must change to remain the same. It's just different people, different time, but the circumstances are often very similar, and people either are ignorant of history or just ignore it. And so it's worse the second time around, the third time around. And incidentally, you haven't heard anything about this, but this whole Wiki scandal involving the release of classified documents with names of informants in Afghanistan. Excuse me. Bradley Manning was gay. His mother was British, his father's American, officer stationed over there, serviceman. Joined the U.S. Army, and then he became gay or was gay, we don't know. And he decided he wanted a sex change, and he had a falling out with his lover. And this is the motivation behind the release of those documents, which has got everybody upset, and especially Afghan informants in Afghanistan. Now, we have another case that's not been reported. And this is the problem, that all this homosexual treachery, especially involving military people, gets censored and suppressed by the homosexuals in the press. That's why you're seeing the drums, the wedding bells ringing, or them ringing the wedding bells for this gay, lesbian, homosexual marriages. Another guy, Jared McIntosh, I think is his name, is a submariner. He was in the communications section of a submarine, and he was living on shore, and he had a cell phone camera, and these are barred on the submarines, as I understand, or in classified in areas, where there's communications in that. So he brings his cell phone with him when he reports to duty on the submarine. This just happened 2 weeks ago. Recently, within the month, and it was confiscated. Well, he got it back a week later, and he got called what they call. He thought he was going to go to captain's mess, but he found he was being court-martialed because on that camera were compromising pictures of him and his boyfriend. So, just how stupid can you be? If he's going to bring a camera, at least erase all the images. Well, I guess So now he's claiming, and he's being discharged for violating on what they call 92, which is part of the Universal Code of Military Justice regulations. And he's being discharged, and he's claiming this is homophobia. And here this guy has violated the basic security. You don't bring cameras or any recording devices in areas which are classified. We had a situation 20 years ago with the Walker family, not related to Judge Walker or George Walker. And this is a family of Navy people. The father, John, had served in the Navy and retired. His brother was in the Navy, and his best friend was in the Navy. And it became the Walker spy ring. They were spying for the Russians. And he had a son who was on the USS Enterprise in the communications section. And he recruited his young son and this kid was taking bags full of printed documents and codes and everything and turning them over to his father, who sold them to the Russians, and they only got $100,000 out of it, but they got, when they were apprehended and convicted, they got the life imprisonment. Should have been executed, in my view. But anyway, this is what goes on. There was no sex thing involved. It was just simple greed of John Walker, and certainly treason and betrayal of his best friend and his brother. And he also tried to get his daughter involved in the spy ring, but the FBI was on to him. But this is what goes on with these people. And excuse me. Security is very important these days, and we have not learned, and I've always said this, that espionage is a dirty but necessary business. Americans have never understood it. They still think it's a Nathan Hale thing. I have only one life to give for my country. You don't want to give your life, and the Russians certainly aren't going to give theirs, and they'll get yours, or take yours, rather. They don't fool around, and we have to realize that security must be maintained, and people who violate security must be severely punished. Or as one of my old buddies used to say, somebody who was in the security services, they would be dealt with extreme prejudice. Those of us who know what that phrase means knows what it means. And that these people deserve that because they put the whole country at risk. We don't have death penalty for espionage, and maybe that should be reinstated. Anyway, coming up, we will have this program will be repeated, and we'll correct the volumes. I'm very sorry. There's no way to adjust this before broadcast, so I'll try some more engineering. It takes a little more time, but I don't want to burst your eardrums. And so, excuse me, I got this bloody cold still. Go to our website, Amicus Veritas, or Verzola.com, VERZOLA.com, and go to our YouTube site, our video magazine, AMICUSVERITAS, excuse me, and we update, we try to get the video. Actually, we've been doing almost a video a day, Video Verite, we call it, and it's become a video magazine. It's a lot of things. Incidentally, here's something of interest. Did you know that some people are beginning have found a way to use the electrical outlets at grocery stores to power up their Wi-Fis and all that. So the question is, are grocery stores doing what Starbucks and other coffee shops are doing and providing free wireless service? I'll let you know what the company said about that one. So that's coming up. And then we'll have some more on the vote fraud, how the radical left, the lavender left, pulled off this vote fraud. I still believe, you know, I would take Gibbs at his word, Mr. O's press secretary, that they don't seem to be worried about retaining control of Congress. And, of course, if they're very experienced at doing vote fraud, we can't, ignore that fact, even though some of the major consultants are saying, "Oh, they're going to take back Republicans, going to take back Congress." Do you really think, those of us who are political realists, that the dirty Democrats or Democrats, the Pelosi, Reid crowd, Rangel and the Waters, that whole crowd, are going to give up power? My view, my experience is not, and what I was once told when I was investigating voter fraud when I was still a student, that I criticized somebody, a prominent Democrat office holder. I said, you should be ashamed of yourself doing this, disenfranchising our votes. And he said, if you got the power, you can make the changes. We got the power, we're not going to give it up, and we're going to prevent you from taking the power. So that's their attitude, and I take them at their word. We've seen what they've done and what they're capable of doing, and you've got to stay ahead of these people. That the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. It's not a trite phrase. It's a very applicable phrase. And if you want to survive without being domestically enslaved by these corrupt politicians with their sleazy, dirty, pedophilic, predatory habits, there's nothing that they won't do. And I think this song. This is San Francisco's unofficial anthem.
But now God knows anything goes. Good offers too, who once knew better words, now only used for letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if fair limbs you like, if May West you like, for me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the sense and smart is intruding and nudist parties in studio, anything goes. When Mrs. Ned McLean, God bless her, can get Russian red to yes, then I suppose anything goes. When Rockefeller still can hoard enough money to let Max Gordon produce his show, anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and that gent today, you gave a cent today, once had several chateaus. When folks who still can ride in jitneys find out Vanderbilts and Whitneys lack baby clothes, anything goes. When Sam Goldwyn can with great conviction instruct Anna Sen in diction, then Anna shows, anything goes. When you hear that Lady Mendel standing up, now does a handspring landing upon her toes, anything goes. Just think of those shocks you got, and those knocks you got, and those blues you got from those news you got, and those pains you got, if any brains you got from those little radios. So Mrs. R, with all her trimmings, can broadcast a bit from Simmons, cause Franklin knows anything goes.
Well, that was Cole Porter singing back in the 30s, his own song he composed for the show Anything Goes. So some of those names you may not recognize, but they are dated, but were very relevant at the time. And it's a great, it was a great show. And if you want to see Cole Porter's life romanticized by Hollywood, see Night and Day with Cary Grant and Alexis Smith, who was Cole Porter, probably one of our greatest songwriters, was gay, and there was a marriage of convenience. He served in the French Army in World War One. And he listened to the music of the Africans, and that's another interesting thing we'll get into. Just discovered a film about the North Africans who served in the French Army in World War II. These were Muslims, and they thought these were Algerians, and they thought they were going to get they were French and all that, and they were discriminated against, abused, that sort of thing. But anyway, this is where Cole Porter got the idea, the creative. Morsel, if you were, or the a musical idea for the good Lord, it's famous African rhythm song that he did, we might play an excerpt from it because it's in the archives, so I think it's okay. Excuse me, I have this. Thing in my throat. Anyway, we'll repeat the show probably Monday, and we're still ironing out some of the little rough spots, and we'll get the volumes correct for the themes. I hope you enjoy the show. Go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. This is Peter Paul Verzola. Thank you for listening, and this will remain in the up on the web so that you can download it or those if you missed some of it. Good night. Mm-hmm. Okay.